My sermon this morning will be about 30 minutes in length, and it's going to cover a lot of ground. And so, as usual, I will provide a print version of the sermon in the coming week, should you tune out for a bit or wish to revisit some of the topics that I will be talking about. Forgiveness has to do with the process of releasing our hatred, hostility, bitterness, and disappointment towards others, ourselves, and reality in general, or all three, so that we are able to say yes to life and get on with our lives. It's hard for me to imagine how anyone could be a mature human being without having developed at least some capacity to forgive. It's simply one of the marks and measures of a developed human life. Additionally, without a generous dose of forgiveness in our lives, we simply aren't going to make it, either individually or even perhaps as a human species. And personally, there's little that moves me more emotionally than to hear of or to witness examples of forgiveness. Again, whether it's in relation to others, ourselves, or with respect to reality in general. I find that the tears spontaneously fill my eyes in the face of such examples of forgiveness. And the reason, I think, for such emotion has to do with the recognition of some obstacle being overcome. Because it strikes me that forgiveness relates to what is the hardest spiritual labor that we humans can undertake. It's the difficult work of the ego in surrendering its plan for life in the face of what reality actually brings us, embracing, as it were, a larger reality, saying as the Christ in Gethsemane, "Not my will, but thine be done." So over my years as a minister, I've delivered many sermons on this subject of forgiveness. And what I thought I would do this morning is give a kind of summary of the main aspects of this subject as I've dealt with it, beginning with the question of whether forgiveness is always called for. This is the question of whether there are acts of such horror, for example, the Jewish Holocaust, that cause everything, including the notion of forgiveness, to pale in front of the magnitude of that horror, the obstacle so huge, so seemingly insurmountable, that one despairs of being able to do anything with it. But the question to my mind then is, well, what is the alternative to forgiving? As insurmountable as a particular obstacle might be, if forgiveness is not possible, then it would seem that one is forever condemned to live under the shadow of that obstacle with no hope of ever coming back into the light. And part of the reason why forgiveness may not seem like a solution to some of the horrors of life is that we may have some faulty and confusing notions about the reality and dynamics of forgiveness. And so I want to spend most of my time with you this morning talking about what forgiveness is and isn't, beginning with that well-worn phrase, forgive and forget. We need to know that forgiveness, though it is the way that opens us to a brighter future, does not necessarily forget the darknesses of the past. The past doesn't disappear just because through the principle of forgiveness, one is now working for a different and more whole future. How can you ever, why should you ever forget the deep hurts and wounds that are so much a part of your life, even when they might be largely healed? If you do forget, you're more likely to get wounded again in the same place. So forgive, but also don't be afraid to remember. There's a little book titled Forgive and Forget by Dr. Lewis Smeads, in which he has a very fine summary of what forgiving is not. Forgiving, he says, is not forgetting or excusing or condoning or accepting or tolerating or smothering conflict. And here's how he puts it. He says, you do not have to forget after you forgive. You may, but your forgiving can be sincere even if you remember. You do not excuse people by forgiving them. You forgive them at all because only because you hold them to account and refuse to excuse them. You do not forgive people by smothering conflict. If you forever smother people's differences, you rob them of a chance to forgive. You do not forgive people merely by accepting them. You forgive people who have done something to you that is unacceptable. And finally, he says, you do not have to tolerate what people do when you forgive them for doing it. You may forgive people, but still refuse to tolerate what they have done. And on the positive side, then, what is forgiveness in relation to others? It's essentially, it seems to me, an internal process, typically a slow one, that takes place in the heart and the mind of the person who feels injured or wronged by another, a process that, as I said in the introduction, has to do with releasing our hatred, hostility, bitterness, and disappointment toward that person, and again, beginning to wish that person well, which can be a kind of test for whether indeed you have forgiven. Do you wish the other person well again? Ironically, one of the things that I have discovered in reflecting on the meaning of forgiveness over the years is that there can be a place for hate and other so-called negative emotions. The emotion of hate, the urge for revenge, the desire to strike back, these can be seen as natural and even perhaps necessary responses to situations that threaten human dignity. When we are stepped on and treated as no human being ought to be treated, or when we see others being stepped on and treated as no human beings ought to be treated, then our hatred and desire to strike back arises in us to let us know that something is wrong, that the situation is intolerable and ought not to be put up with. Additionally, our hatred lets us know that we are fighting back against this situation and that we have something to fight back with. As one author on the subject of forgiveness puts it, not to feel resentment when resentment is called for is a sign of servility, a lack of self-respect. But of course, there's also a problem with hate and resentment when we hang on to it long after the event. Hate, as Dr. Smead says, can keep us going while we feel battered, but the drive dies down as time goes on after the ordeal is over. And then the hate turns its power against the hater. It corrodes from the inside. It saps the energy of the soul. Fred Luskin, an author, puts it this way. He says, not forgiving, staying in bitterness, anger, and hostility is like drinking a cup of poison and waiting for the other person to die. The process of releasing our hatred is the process of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a way of not letting a past event take you over. Forgiveness is a way of not letting a past event take you over. It's a way of not being a victim anymore. So forgiveness is the medicine for the injury, and I just don't know what other medicine there could be. It's the medicine that will eventually heal the open wounds to our psyche and to our spirit. But again, we must also be clear, as I've indicated, that forgiveness does not erase the disfigurement or the scar tissue from those wounds. Because when you have been wounded, particularly if you've been badly wounded, you may expect that there will always be a tenderness at the place of the injury. Touch that scar tissue, you will remember. And I remember some years ago on a parish visit, speaking with a lovely 85-year-old woman who told me that finally, just in the last few years, she was able to forgive a stepmother who had treated her cruelly when she was a youngster of around 10 years old. She said that she had been working on trying to get over her hatred for her stepmother all her life. And it was only recently that she had been able to do it. And yet, when she spoke to me of those times 75 years ago, she wept at the memory of it. The place was still tender to the touch. And so, forgiveness does not undo or erase the past. It doesn't mean that everything is now as it once was. It doesn't mean you necessarily think the person forgiven is not now dangerous for you. And it doesn't necessarily mean you want the person for a bosom friend. Again, to quote Dr. Smeeds, who says, "When you forgive, you heal your hate for the person who created that reality, but you do not change the facts, and you do not undo all of their consequences. The dead stay dead. The wounded are often still crippled." And so, just as some physical wounds never entirely heal, so too, some of our soul wounds may be so deep that they never entirely heal, regardless of how much we try to forgive and move beyond our hatred. Now, with regard to the dynamics and reality of forgiveness, we also need to distinguish between forgiveness, this internal process of releasing hate, and reconciliation, which has to do with the results of that internal process of forgiveness in the outer world. So what forgiveness does is open the possibility of reconciliation with another person, but it does not necessarily lead to reconciliation. Because for reconciliation to take place, trust has to be built up again. And trust is something that must be earned over time and through experience. It simply cannot be granted upon request. So reconciliation has some preconditions, or at least it ought to have. And not least of those preconditions is the recognition on the part of the offending parties as to how they have given injury, as well as some demonstration of change in respect to their behavior. Certainly, of course, it's easier to forgive when there is a recognition of offense on the part of the other, some expression of regret, remorse, perhaps an apology, as in the poem of my reading this morning. But here's the thing. We cannot make forgiveness depend on the offending party. So just think about that for a minute. It would be a terrible thing if forgiveness depended on the attitude and actions of the one causing the injury, for we might thereby forever be held in bondage to a past about which we could do nothing. So think, for example, of a father or mother now in the grave, who never expressed regret or sorrow for ways they may have damaged their children, or teachers from one's school days that seemed to delight in humiliating their students, or the cruelty of schoolmates who bullied or teased. You know, such examples could be multiplied many times, and thus forgiveness cannot depend on the recognition, remorse, or repentance of others. If forgiveness did have such preconditions, our lives would be at the mercy of countless past events and injuries that we are helpless to change. And forgiveness has everything to do with change. It has to do with changing our response to the past so that we are able to move on with respect to it. And let me illustrate this idea that forgiveness is an internal process, and that reconciliation in the outer world is another matter. I have a friend. He practices the spiritual discipline of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of dealing with his addiction to alcohol. And forgiveness, as many of you may know, is a pivotal part of that spiritual discipline, but It's forgiveness with an important clarification, at least as understood by my friend. My friend says that he never asks other persons to forgive him. My job, he says, is essentially twofold. First, with respect to myself, I work on forgiving both myself and others. I try to quit hating myself and beating up on myself for the damage that I've done to my life, and I work as well on forgiving others for the part that they've played in damaging my life. That first of all, he says. And then secondly, says my friend, my job with respect to others is to work on uncovering how I may have hurt and injured them and to express to them my sorrow for my deeds and attitudes and to the extent I can to try to make amends. But he says, I don't ask others to forgive me or to reconcile with me. That, he says, is up to them. I make an apology to them on the basis of my spiritual task and with no expectations or strings attached. How my apology is received, that's their business. I can't pressure, he says, I can't pressure another person to forgive me for what I've done. All I can do is express my remorse and apologize to them. And so, confession may be easier, confession may be given and repentance proffered, and that no doubt makes it easier to forgive, but forgiveness cannot be coerced, it cannot be demanded. Another way of expressing this distinction between forgiveness and reconciliation is to understand that the principle of forgiveness does not undo the principle of justice. Justice essentially has to do with three things. One, holding people responsible for their actions. Two, protecting the injured parties. And three, to the extent possible, making amends to the injured parties. Forgiveness does not erase these demands of justice. As a matter of fact, without justice, the principle of forgiveness is undermined. Because without justice, the victims are at the mercy of the perpetrators, who often are not noted for being particularly merciful. And thus, to forgive without justice, to forgive without accountability, is to set oneself up again, which shows a lack of respect for human dignity and self-worth. But the reverse is also true, namely, that forgiveness is needed to make justice work. Without forgiveness, justice is undermined. Justice alone will not do the trick. Justice and forgiveness belong together, and without each other, they both fall. Why? Why is this? Why does justice need forgiveness to support it? Well, I think because this is a broken world, and it's a constantly breaking world, which is always in need of repair. This is a world in which we all fall short in oh so many, many ways on oh so many, many days. No amount of recompense can undo the damage done to our world. And no system of justice can restore everything that has been broken. Only forgiveness restores. Only forgiveness is creative. Now, let me add a couple more things on forgiveness. Hopefully, you have a little bit more bandwidth. But first, I want to reflect for a bit on a line by poet Stephen Dunn that reads, "It was easy to forgive, so much harder to be forgiven. It was easy to forgive, so much harder to be forgiven." So much harder to be forgiven than to forgive. Well, yes. For how do you feel when someone comes up to you and says, "You will be happy to know that I have forgiven you." actually, you may not be so happy at all to hear this news, because you didn't think you had done anything wrong that required forgiveness. And the person who is happily announcing his or her forgiveness of you shouldn't have taken offense in the first place, was too thin-skinned, too easily offended, didn't understand at all what you were about, didn't know the fullness of the circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. And so, well, at some level, you may be happy that the other person has resolved some issue for him or herself. At another level, it might have been just as well if he or she had not announced it to you. Because now, indeed, you do have some stuff to work through with respect to the other person. Soon, there may be good reason for the other to forgive. But why? Why might it be more difficult to be the one needing to be forgiven than the one in the position of forgiving? The reason, I think, is because the one forgiving the other is the more magnanimous, more godlike figure, the one with the power. It's hard to be the party needing forgiveness. And so it is that we don't want to make mistakes that would put us in the position where we are the ones that need to be forgiven, where we may feel that we have to grovel until the power person releases us from our prison. And what if that person refuses to release us from that underdog position? And thus, we greatly fear making mistakes and what they will mean for our place in life. And so secondly, if we have made mistakes, we'd rather not acknowledge those mistakes. As a matter of fact, sometimes we'd rather do anything than acknowledge or recognize our need to be forgiven because of what we imagine this means for our place in life and for our image of ourselves, and how such an acknowledgement may complicate and upset our lives and call upon us to change our ways. And this brings me back then briefly to the psychological dynamics of forgiveness and back to the introduction of this sermon, in which I spoke of forgiveness as being the hardest spiritual work imaginable, because it has to do with the ego adjusting itself to a reality that it would rather not have to face. I see a paradox here, namely, the capacity to forgive comes from the paradoxical combination of having both ego strength and ego humility at the same time, of having a sense of one's self-worth on the one hand and a sense of one's minute finiteness on the other. The process of forgiveness has to do with the process of the ego being strong enough to digest those aspects of reality that it would rather not have to digest. But to the extent that the ego can digest whatever obstacle is before it, I think, for example, of a Nelson Mandela digesting his very difficult reality. To the extent that the ego is strong enough to digest the seemingly indigestible, to that extent, it becomes stronger and more resilient, as in these proverbs, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, or the demon you swallow gives you its strength. The directions or fronts that the ego has to work with, as I said in my opening statement of the sermon, are three in number: forgiving ourselves, forgiving others, and forgiving reality, nature, God, whatever term works for you. The first front has to do with all the ways that we feel we've been injured by others, unfairnesses, injustices, abuses, some things horrific beyond words. The second front has to do with ways that we feel we have not measured up, have disappointed ourselves, feel unworthy, have injured and hurt others. And again, some things we have done to ourselves or others are horrific beyond words. How can they possibly be forgiven? And then thirdly, less spoken of, is our forgiveness of reality. For indeed, if we were the creator, we can imagine a few things that we might like to change. I think, for example, here of Robert Frost's humorous and edgy poetic couplet on forgiveness. Asked at a gathering one time to offer an opening prayer, Frost came up with the following two-line rhyming prayer when he said, "Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me." And Frost also said he was never more serious than when he was fooling. So as part of forgiveness, I include larger reality, forgiving reality for being the way it is, and saying yes to it in spite of improvements that we might imagine for it. And finally, whence comes the power to forgive? I think, again, the answer is another paradox. The same power of nature that we sometimes feel is our adversary and which we might like to correct is also a creative power that continually moves forward, a creative power that is infinitely larger than our little ego self and to which our ego self can connect. Forgiveness, as with so much in life, has to do with letting go of ego control and of connecting with a creative power larger and greater than itself. The name you attach to this creative power is not important, but the process of opening to it, of having faith in it, of giving yourself to it, there, I believe, is where the power to forgive ourselves and others comes from. And to the extent, to experience the power of such forgiveness is what I would call to experience the grace of the world. I'll conclude our visit this morning to this vast subject of forgiveness with an analogy on the power of forgiveness that I once heard in a sermon from the Reverend Dr. Forrest Church, who was the longtime minister of the All Souls Unitarian Church in New York City. He died of, I think it was esophageal cancer in 2009 at the age of 61. But this was a sermon that I heard Forrest deliver in the winter of 1988, way back. And it was a sermon that was given shortly after he had seen the movie Peggy Sue Got Married, which just happens to be a favorite movie of mine, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. In the movie, Peggy Sue, played by Kathleen Turner, is at her 20th high school reunion. But her dreams from high school are in pieces. Her marriage is on the rocks with divorce proceedings underway. Still beautiful and popular, however, she's elected queen of the reunion prom. But just as she's about to receive the crown, she faints and finds herself transported back in time to her high school years, but now with full consciousness of what has transpired in those intervening 20 years. In other words, she now has a chance to relive her life with full knowledge of the mistakes she's made. What would you change about your life if you had the chance to go back and live a part of it over again? One of the scenes in the movie that I can never get through without watery eyes is the time Peggy Sue's grandmother calls her on the phone. But Peggy Sue, having already lived through this, knows what is about to happen. She knows that this will be her last chance to talk to her grandmother, since she knows her grandmother will die in just a couple of days. Peggy Sue is so overcome hearing her grandmother's voice, she can't speak. And she surprises her family then, who do not have knowledge of her future, by taking a day off from school to visit her grandparents to be with them one more time. By being able to go back in time, Peggy Sue takes some chances she didn't take at the time. She sees a lot of things that she couldn't and didn't see at the time. And she discovers as well some things about her husband that she hadn't known about. so that when she wakes up from her magical spell, she has a broader perspective. She's able to forgive herself and him and willing to start over again. Forgiveness is like that. It's like having the power to travel back in time, to revisit events, and to change them by making different choices with respect to them. Not literally, as Peggy Sue is able to do in the movie, but to reframe those past events by bringing a larger and more mature consciousness to them, thus shifting those events and opening up a whole different future with respect to them. That, my friends, is the power of forgiveness.